Donald Trump has been in office 1 month. This hour, a look back at his first 30 days and a look ahead to the challenges that await the new president and Congress. It's a special edition of River to River, Pints in Politics, today coming to you in a program recorded at the Mill in downtown Iowa City. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're gathered again together, just as we like to think the citizens did in the taverns during the time of our founding fathers, to enjoy a few local brews and to ferment some lively, perhaps some feisty political discussion with our panelists, Gazette political reporter James Lynch. Gazette columnist Linda Waddington. And columnist Todd Dorman. Later on the program, we want to talk about state politics. That coming a little bit later in the program. We welcome questions from our audience. Our audience does have slips of paper, so please turn those in to the various people from the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio to hand forward. We'll get to as many as we can a little bit later. Later, we'll talk state politics. We'll start with the federal picture, first of all. Now that Republicans are in the driver's seat at the Iowa State House, we're going to be asking, where are they taking us? But first, President Trump's first month in office. It's hard to know where to begin. We have so many things to talk about. We'll try to touch on the major things and elaborate from there. Observers have used words like chaos or turmoil to describe the first month. The president himself says he's running, quote, a fine-tuned machine. So I want to turn to our panelists, first of all, to say, how would you describe the first month under Donald Trump?
I'll go first.
Okay, Linda.
Unprepared.
Unprepared. Understandable, though, isn't it? We were all unprepared, even Donald Trump, for this election victory of his campaign.
Well, you know, you would hope that once you become the nominee for a major political party, that regardless of what polling is showing or regardless of what people are whispering in your ear, that you actually prepare to do that job. And it's kind of disappointing that that wasn't happening throughout the summer, throughout the fall, and then it became kind of this mad dash once November happened.
Didn't it seem to be happening after the election? I mean, like between November 8th and January 20th, it didn't seem to be happening either. And I think it's evident. I mean, I don't know what a well-oiled machine means to Donald Trump, but it kind of reminds me.
Fine-tuned accuracy in reporting, please, James.
It kind of reminds me of my old lawnmower that when I would tune it up in the spring and think it was running well, and then I'd have to take it down to the hardware store for repairs. It's just sort of discouraging that he wasn't ready to lead on January 20th, and there's just been a number of miscues, and just it seems like a lot of wasted time.
Mm-hmm. Though I think when we look at the number of cabinet appointments confirmed or named into the position, I think he's on par with people like Bill Clinton and some other recent presidents, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, his the degree by which his picks have caused controversy is probably much higher than those guys. I might say it's well-oiled chaos, because I think each day when you get up and deliver a tweet and then all hell breaks loose the rest of the day, and I think that's kind of by design. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, as Steve Bannon was at the CPAC today talking about how they were trying to they're looking at the administrative regulatory executive branch of the country, and they're trying to deconstruct it. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like an interesting, you know, thesis for a master's thesis, but I'm not sure it's how to govern the country. And I think that's part of the problem, is that you've got a lot of guys that have been on sort of the edges of politics with all of these ideas, and now they're at the center of politics with all of these ideas, and they're figuring out to some extent maybe these ideas aren't the sort of ideas you can use to govern the country. Right. And they're going to run into lots of problems, and that's what we've seen so far.
You mentioned tweeting. Did I mention that this, of course, we have our pints in hand. We're enjoying this. So we're kind of making this like a little bit of a drinking game. If you panelists, any of you mention the word tweet, you risk having to draw from the tweet pint glass. There is a There is a pint glass on the table there, and these are noteworthy, deemed newsworthy tweets from our president in his first 30 days of office. And so, Todd Dorman, I will ask you to reach into the tweet jar, the tweet pint glass, and here, one more rule. After reading it aloud into the microphone, you may choose to tweet back yourself or turn to James or Linda, and they will have to tweet back if you choose not to. Okay, go ahead, Todd. What did you pick?
The fake news media failing New York Times, NBC News, ABC, CBS, CNN is not my enemy. It is the enemy of the American people.
Okay, there we go. Here. Are you going to tweet back at that, or are you going to choose Linda or James to tweet back?
I'm going to choose Linda.
She looks ecstatic about that. Good. So the enemy of the people, not only the enemy of Donald Trump, but the enemy of the people. This is an interesting comment.
Nevertheless, she persisted.
Okay, that's your tweet back.
You know, as Todd was saying earlier, you have a lot of people that just continue to respond to Donald Trump with delete your account, that meme that's going on. And it's very hard to stomach a president, a sitting president, saying that the media, the free media, is somehow the enemy of the American people.
Mm-hmm. James, what do you think about that? That the president has picked out two mighty foes, or two foes, let's just say it that way, to begin his presidency. One, the judiciary, and the other one, you in the press. I guess me as well.
I hope it wasn't personal, but you know what I find interesting, and there, you see a lot of comparisons between Donald Trump and Richard Nixon in their hatred of the press, and with the caveat that I was graduating from high school about the time that Richard Nixon resigned the presidency, it seems to me that Richard Nixon really hated the press and really hated the media. With Donald Trump, I'm not sure that he does. I think it's more like it's just his foil. That he knows that if he says, you know, the Washington Post is failing and CNN is fake news, that it garners a whole lot of attention. And I think it plays well with his base, who look at, you know, what do they call CNN, the counterfeit news network or whatever. You know, and so it plays well with his base. I don't know if there's really any true animosity or hatred towards the media. It's just that it's a good foil.
And
everybody needs a straight man or a foil, and we're the foil.
Let's talk about a couple of the major issues, the major moves that the new president has made here, your reaction to those, perhaps how you've been writing about them in your columns, Todd and Linda. During his campaign, Donald Trump pledged to create, in his words, a deportation task force. Now we heard in the last few days that he's boosting the ranks of federal immigration agents and giving them wider latitude to arrest and detain undocumented immigrants. How have you been reacting to that as columnists?
Well, people are going to have – I mean, as this goes forward, it's going to be one of those issues where as people are deported from communities and these are people that folks know and they have – roles in the community. I mean, that's when this immigration debate is going to get real for a lot of people. And I guess if this is the course of action that we still want after we realize that there are people in communities that do jobs and play roles and are, you know, our neighbors, if we still want a deportation force to take people out of the country, at least we know what we're actually doing.
Right. And Iowa's perspective on this, and I'm sure the Gazette has reported on this, I know, as well as Iowa Public Radio, is that as a state dependent on an agricultural industry, we have built these people into our workforce. I don't know what the implications are for us as we see this new immigration policy develop here.
Well, you know, I think you look at it in terms of the public good. It's one thing for the president to say we're going to, you know, deport felons and people who have committed violent crimes, and we can all agree that, yeah, we're better off without felons in our communities. But when you have somebody who, whether they came illegally or not, they're here, they're raising their family, how is the public good served by deporting these people, whether we need them in our workforce? What's the public good?
Closely related to what I just mentioned, Donald Trump has issued, well, I guess due to issue a revision of his temporary travel ban targeting majority Muslim countries. Let's just call it travel ban 2.0. I guess the new order would focus on the same seven countries that were in the original travel ban, but would bar entry to those without a visa and those who have never entered the U.S. before. Also, unlike the original order, people from those countries who already have permanent U.S. residency, green cards, visas would not face any restrictions. I wonder, what is this this reissuing of a tweaked order tell us? Because of course he was faced down by the judiciary, who in our district or courts, federal courts, said that didn't work in the first attempt.
I think it's an admission to what we talked about at the beginning, that he was absolutely unprepared for what he was doing once he got in office. I think most people going into the office would have known that they had to check with the judiciary. They would have had to check with the Justice Department. They would have had to vet this across numerous departments.
I mean, this order will be better, implemented, but that I don't think it's changed enough to mean that it's going to be accepted by the courts. I think there's still going to be a challenge, and it's still going to face fairly strict scrutiny.
We're talking about the first 30 days of the Trump presidency. A lot of critical remarks we've heard over the last few minutes. I wonder if our panel can point to successes, depending on the media you pay attention to. And our media in this country has become as fractured as the people it serves. You will see the president as a very successful 30-day president so far, or unsuccessful. What can we point to as successes at this point from the new president?
The closest to success that I can think of is not really what the president has done, but sort of the damage control that his cabinet members and vice president have been called on to do, reassuring our allies in NATO, going to Mexico today and telling them that we're not going to mobilize the military to round up illegal undocumented residents. It seems like if there is any silver lining, it is sort of the damage control the rest of the Trump administration is trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
But
I guess pointing to a
success by the president, I'm not sure, other than his rally last weekend.
Right. I guess I should define success more clearly. Success, as you would any candidate, defined by the campaign promises that were outlined and that this president was elected to by the Electoral College, if not the popular vote. So what about the unveiling of Neil Gorsuch as his nominee for the open Supreme Court seat?
Yeah, I mean, Gorsuch probably was a choice that, I mean, if you talk to a lot of senators, they can accept him as a Supreme Court nominee. If you think about who he might have nominated, Gorsuch, I suppose, would be a success.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to please liberals in the Senate. He's not going to please liberal legal scholars. But, he seems like somebody who falls somewhere within the sort of the mainstream of judicial discretion.
Well, he's the sort of nominee that all of the conservative Republicans who sort of reluctantly backed Trump said all along, well, we're backing him because we want the Supreme Court to not go too far, the balance to be tilted left. So, I mean, in that, I suppose it's a success. He provided, or he fulfilled the promise to those folks.
One of the other campaign promises that was at every stump speech you would have attended that Donald Trump was at was a repeal and replacement of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Describe what you think or your thoughts on the predicament, if that's what it is, that the Republican-controlled Congress has on its hands now.
Well, one reason they're in a box is because, before Obamacare, there was sort of a set of potential ideas that folks in the Heritage Foundation and other conservative think tanks sort of floated out there for how you could achieve larger coverage, universal coverage, one of which was the individual mandate. There were all sorts of ideas out there. Obama adopted quite a few of those ideas. That was from that sort of the apparatus of where conservative ideas come from. That was then branded as tyranny. So now, as conservatives are trying to piece together some sort of response or replacement plan, they can't use any of that stuff. Well, they're going to try to use some of it because it's turned out to be popular. But that's the rub. If you want to do expanded coverage, you have to figure out how to help people afford insurance. And if you get rid of subsidies and all of those things, then people aren't going to be able to afford insurance. And so you're going to lose, you know, there are going to be millions of people that aren't covered. And that's what they don't want to do now. But they're going to have to do it if they want to repeal it.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're recorded program at the Mill in downtown Iowa City. It's Pints and Politics with our panelists, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, you just heard, James Lynch of the Gazette. Let's talk a little bit more about the Affordable Care Act, because I know, James, in reading one of your columns, I believe you attended one of the town hall meetings of Senator Grassley, the Congress in recess, and many of our congressional delegation here in Iowa to hold town halls to the degree that they want or don't want. You were in Iowa Falls. What did you witness there?
Well, I suppose we could go back to our first question. Was it chaos or a finely tuned town hall meeting? It was pretty interesting. About 200 people crowded into a fire station and shouting out questions and insults and whatever at Grassley. At times, it certainly was chaotic. And he covered, I don't know, probably 15 different questions during that time. There was a lot of interest in the Affordable Care Act and preserving it for the most part. People there wanted it maintained or preserved. It was an unusual town hall for Grassley in that in most of his town halls there's more back and forth where he gives an answer and somebody responds and he expounds on it. In this case, you know, 10 people shouted questions at him and he tried to answer one and then moved on to the next topic. For the most part, there were people who were concerned about the Affordable Care Act, about immigration, about, you know, every topic that we've talked about, and not necessarily on his side and not very pleased with his answers for the most part. But at least he was there having the dialogue.
Yeah, and I big props to Senator Grassley that he is the only member of the Iowa delegation that continues to publish a public schedule on his website. The only one. And I think Iowans lose a lot when we can't get face-to-face with the people who represent us. And as much as I'm going to give props to Grassley, I'm going to give non-props. I don't know if non-props is actually something that happens. to my representative, Rob Blum, did not meet with anyone. And my understanding from readers emailing me is that he actually is doing something by telephone. And whether or not that is an open forum or not, I think there's always this perception that the staff members involved with those calls are cherry-picking what questions.
Here's a question from one of our audience members here at the Mill in Iowa City. A topic I wanted to get to, but I'll get to it by way of this question. Why aren't we hearing more about looking into Russian hacking of our elections, since elections are the foundation of our democracy? So this is interesting. We have our intelligence agencies, I think numbering 17, in consensus that our elections were that the Russians were active. They were active on the part of influencing the elections on behalf of Donald Trump. And we have a national security advisor who served the shortest term of any in history. Michael Flynn was ushered out after 24, 25 days, something like that. And now we have a new national security advisor here. But still, we have Republicans in control of Congress. And we have questions about what actually happened during our election. The question, perhaps, what type of investigation is needed here to get to the truth? And how important is it anyway?
I think there's a very real fear that if we investigate it fully and accurately, that there will be a delegitimization of Donald Trump's presidency. And I don't see a Republican-controlled Congress willing to risk that.
Todd?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Linda. It's the sort of thing that, you know, when one party controls all of the levers of power, it's difficult to get an investigation into something that's going to embarrass that party. Of course, it's important because, I mean, this is a foreign government and potentially a hostile government that's sort of meddled in our elections. And I mean, you know, did the Trump campaign in any way collude in any of the hacking? Were they did they communicate with the Russians and encourage this? I mean, that's a big question. And if the answer is yes, then that's going to have pretty serious implications. So should it be investigated? Of course. Will it? I think there will, you know, there will be attempts, but I'm not sure how strenuous they'll be.
I love this question. I've just picked up, handed to me by an audience member here at the Mill in Iowa City, by a self-described lifelong Republican here in our midst. Donald Trump is a symptom, he or she writes, not a choice, even for Republicans. What do you see as the three primary underlying causes for the Trump symptom to have occurred, in your opinion? Interesting. Sort of a diagnosis.
Well, first, I think it's an alternate fact because I don't think there are any lifelong Republicans in Johnson County, are there? I don't know if I can come up with three reasons, but, you know,
there are three of you. Maybe if each of you come up with one.
Maybe we put our heads together or something. But, you know, people wanted change. And I think so much so that they were willing to accept Donald Trump.
Right.
I mean, there are, what, 17 Republican candidates that, you know, you could rank from best to worst or worst to worser or something, but depending on your point of view. But I think if you're a conservative, Donald Trump probably was, you know, not a conservative. Yeah. He's hardly a Republican in a lot of ways. And yet people wanted change so badly, and the media sort of played along with him so well that here he is, unprepared and perhaps surprised himself that he's in the White House. But that's what we got.
Well, and people wanted change, but there's also a lot of fear of change. I mean, the country's changing demographically. Technology is changing the economy. It's replacing people's jobs. Globalization has changed the economy. I think there's just a lot of folks that look at all that, all the demographic change. The, you know, there's a lot of talk about political correctness with regards to that. And they saw Donald Trump as somebody who could, you know, take the country back to a time when, you know, middle-aged white guys like me sort of ran the show. So, I mean, that's...
Those were the days, yeah.
I mean, pull my demographic and 6 or 7 in 10 guys voted for Trump, so...
Okay. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a minute to talk more Pints and Politics with Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and James Lynch of the Gazette. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. More of Pints and Politics is yet to come. Well, we can imagine over 200 years ago, our founding fathers gathering in taverns to drink pints of locally brewed beer. And that's what we're doing today on this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer at the Mill in Iowa City. It's Pints and Politics. And we're back with the second half of this program. Our Gazette columnists here, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and political reporter James Lynch in the hot seats. There are three hot seats up there. Do they feel hot? I don't know. Do they feel hot?
It's a little warm.
A little warm, says Todd.
The beer is helping.
The beer is cooling things down here at the Mill in Iowa City. This hour, we want to get back to a few little points of national politics to be commented on yet, and then move to state politics. Of course, a lot happening there. Let's go back to some questions to finish up talking with our panel here. Another question from our audience here at the Mill in Iowa City. This in the most recent news from national politics, why do you think people are so concerned about toilets, transsexual or otherwise? Is this really a problem or just a red herring? Of course, in the last couple of days, Donald Trump rescinding the executive order that said that, I guess, if I'm characterizing it correctly, that students in our schools can go to the bathroom which corresponds with their sexual identity, not necessarily their birth gender.
Of all the things that the Trump administration has done, I find this to be the most mean-spirited and vindictive. And I will tell you why. The Obama administration issued guidelines to public schools that basically advised them that they believe a part of the Title IX civil rights protections included transgender students being able to use bathrooms according to the gender identity they held at that time. It's already going through the courts. It's been going through the courts. The guidance that the Obama administration had issued was basically a moot point until the courts got done with it. But yet the Trump administration felt obligated, for whatever reasons, to go ahead and rescind that order, even though that order had no force of law. That's just vindictive.
I don't know. It really strikes me as odd when you think about Republicans, conservatives, saying the federal government should be determining who goes to which bathroom. I mean, talk about overreach of the federal government. I think that's example A.
This issue is supposed to be a state issue, but now they're preparing to go after the states that legalize recreational marijuana. So I guess state issues are only state issues when you don't want them to be federal issues.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's turn to state politics. Plenty to chew over there as well. Let's talk about collective bargaining. James, can I turn to you? It's become law now. What did the governor sign? How are unions treated differently now than they were?
I don't think James was invited to watch the governor sign.
No. Specifically not. We asked to be there, but we were not invited.
The Gazette was turned down.
All media were turned down.
Except for the one lobbyist.
It was not a public bill signing.
Right.
It was just there was one member of the public there, but apparently he was some guy that the governor really didn't know.
He was paid to be there.
Well, but the governor said he didn't know who he was. He was just, you know, I have my picture taken with a lot of people.
You're dancing around it.
Yes.
Let's just be transparent. It was a Koch brothers lobbyist, right?
But, you know, to his credit, he was one of the very few people who spoke in favor of the bill at public hearings. So he was rewarded.
If you had only brought some dark money, you might have been able to get into that bill.
I guess. But, you know, the state of the newspaper industry, we don't have any money.
Yeah, exactly.
Dark or light or
money.
People say that Iowa is walking the route of our neighbors to the northeast, Wisconsin. Is that true? Is that what's happening to our labor unions?
Well, this legislation was very similar to what we've seen in Wisconsin and some other states, Indiana, I believe. And I mean, it's, you know, you talk to people who have looked at what the Koch brothers have proposed, and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a very conservative group, promoting these sorts of laws. This is very similar. It's just sort of cut and paste from their legislative model legislation. Model legislation in itself is, you know, not exclusive to those groups. I mean, pretty much every group out there that lobbies state legislatures offers model legislation. But, yeah, it's part of the playbook.
It limits what is included in collective bargaining, if I understood that correctly.
It limits it to basically basic wages.
Not health care, not some other things.
Health care is mandated, but it's not subject to bargaining.
This current collective, or the old, now we say the old collective bargaining law, dates back to the 1970s, early 1970s, when we had teacher strikes in the state. So a lot of this not in the living memory. Well, I look out and I see gray hair, so it is in the living memory of people in this establishment here. But what are your thoughts? Let's turn to our columnists, people who are paid to have opinions. Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman. What are your thoughts on this?
One of the more interesting aspects of the bill is that unions have to recertify every year. So they have to take a vote. And if people don't vote, it's automatically assumed they're a no vote. And I'm kind of in favor of that. I think we ought to apply that to elections in the future.
An interesting concept.
It was pointed out in the collective bargaining debate how many members of the legislature would not be there if that rule applied to legislative races. Because several of them, I think there's one who only got like 29% of the vote in his district.
But I will say, to a certain extent, I think the Democrats bear some responsibility for it getting to this point. I mean, for a long time, we have known that certain aspects of collective bargaining in Iowa needed reforms. They needed to be reviewed. They need to be looked at. For instance, the arbitration, which has for a long time been all or nothing, where arbitrators couldn't say, no, let's meet somewhere in the middle. And Democrats in the Senate have refused to open even those aspects of collective bargaining. So I think part of it is also this pent up from Republicans after 20 years trying to get something through, trying to make some changes. I don't agree with the bill. I think the bill went too far. But I think Democrats could have headed some of this off much earlier if they had been willing to compromise and come to the table.
Yeah, I'm not sure in this climate, though, that it would have mattered so much if they'd done tweaks over the years. I think there was a pretty clear drive to do what happened in Wisconsin and to sort of defang public sector unions, especially due to their, you know, their political clout. They right. they did tend to back Democrats, the ISCA,
and help us out with the GOP rationale for this is that public unions, public sector unions, are getting a much better deal than the private sector, right?
Well, there's conflicting studies on that, I guess. Is that
right?
Depends on who you ask.
Yeah, you can find a study that will support your opinion. One of the speakers said that if you look at upper management, they're probably underpaid in the public sector. If you look at sort of the – like a lot of kind of the middle – folks in the middle, whether they're blue collar or white collar, they're overpaid. There's sort of this – I don't know, wage envy or salary envy, probably more even the benefit envy. In a lot of communities, when you talk to people, they look at teachers, they look at DHS workers or you know, snowplow drivers, and they say, you know, they get a good salary and they've got fantastic benefits that, you know, if you're working down at the local Smith Brothers manufacturing, you probably don't get those sorts of benefits.
Right. And so why not save taxpayers the money?
Sure.
In this case.
Because I think you set up a race to the bottom. I mean, if your whole goal is to say that nobody should be making wages here because we all should be making wages down here, then it becomes a race to see how many people can make wages down here and what aspirations do you have to lift them up above that? I mean, that's what we're seeing in Wisconsin, correct?
Well, you know, that's we had a collective bargaining law that unions were able to use to negotiate for wages and benefits, and they did pretty well. I mean, those were existing laws. You know, when someone like, you know, just say who's a billionaire we know, you know, maybe Donald Trump, you know, uses the existing laws to avoid paying taxes and become rich, there's some sort of economic hero. When a union worker does it, it's, you know, they're a leech. So, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a good way to look at things. I think this could have been a process that could have been deliberative. We could have done some tweaks to collective bargaining. We could have done some updates. But instead, we decided to take 10 days and gut the law and win a big political victory and invite the lobbyists in for a bill signing. And I think that's just an unfortunate process, an unfortunate end for a law that was seen by many for a long time as a landmark and an evidence of bipartisan cooperation.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, columnist of the Gazette with us, also James Lynch, political reporter, in a program recorded before an audience at the Mill in Iowa City, our first time out, Pints and Politics at the Mill in Iowa City, the Gazette moving around the state in the coming months. So stay tuned to find out where our next Pints and Politics will be from. Question from our audience here related to the collective bargaining. Do we know, ask this person here, do we know the political affiliation or affiliations of the union workers who will be impacted by the collective bargaining changes? If so, has the GOP upset a significant group of supporters?
Well, if you go by the number of people who spoke at the public comment sessions, there are a lot of Republicans in the union. One police officer said, you know, look, most of us are conservative. We have conservative values. We vote Republican. We heard some correctional officers talking about voting Republican. What's going to be interesting is to see in 2018 if some of those Republican union members primary the Republican incumbents. You know, you could have Labor Republicans running in 2018, which would set up a really interesting primary election.
Right. And for those who are not political junkies, getting primaried means being
challenged,
being challenged in a primary before you even get to the general election.
Right. Challenged within your own party.
Mm-hmm. Another question from our audience. If the Republicans, this goes to a different aspect of here that we're getting to in at least as I read it, to the minimum wage debate. We have, what is it, four counties in Iowa, including this county, Johnson County, Linn County, Wapello County. What county am I leaving out?
Polk
County, raising the minimum wage on their own to varying degrees. And the Republican-led legislature not so happy with that. Here's a question. If the Republicans in the legislature are in favor of local control, why are they driven to take authority away from cities and school boards?
I don't know how to answer that, because that is the big question. I mean, we've had Republicans running around the state for a long time talking about local control, local control, local control, but yet we can't start the school year before the gates at the Iowa State Fair close. We can't keep plastic bags out of our landfills. We're not supposed to raise the minimum wage, even though that we know we have people that who cannot live on the wages that are minimum wage. So I don't know. I mean, that's a question. I don't have an answer to it either.
Well, it's sort of like Todd said earlier, we're all for states' rights, or conservatives are all for states' rights, except when they're not. Everybody's for home rule, except when they're not. And this year, there doesn't seem to be too many people in the legislature who are for home rule.
Yeah, and part of it is sort of a rural-urban thing, because, you know, Republicans, many of which come from rural districts, don't want to see these urban city councils and county boards of supervisor, you know, undo what they do at the state house. They want that, you know, they want a low minimum, the lower minimum wage to rule. They want the gun rules to be in effect. They don't want extra civil rights protections or other things that will get in the way of business. They don't want Democrats and city councils and county boards to,
yeah,
you know, sort of dig holes in the great agenda that's being passed now.
If you just joined us, it's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, presented in conjunction with our partners at the Gazette. And you've been listening to Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, a columnist with the Gazette, as well as political reporter James Lynch. I'm Iowa Public Radio's Ben Kiefer, winding up our session before a live audience at the Mill in Iowa City, sort of reenacting what our founding fathers, perhaps as we imagine them, getting together over local brews, talking about politics, having a little feisty conversation, talking about national politics and state politics. So many things to talk about. We won't get to this hour. That won't be heard on the broadcast. Well, let's talk a little bit about an area, it seems, of bipartisan agreement. I've certainly done some interviews about this. So you talk about distracted and impaired driving. In 2015, if I'm remembering my statistics right, something like 320 deaths on Iowa roads. That jumping in 2016 to over 400. So we have an increase here. At the same time, we see nationwide an increase of 4 to 8% of deaths on our roads nationwide. And it's not a coincidence. We're finding out that we're doing a lot more than driving when we're behind the wheel. We are texting. We are calling. So the idea here is, I guess, one that's finding popularity, favor in both parties, is to just say, you know, you can't have an electronic device in your hands. I don't care if you're texting or calling. It's got to be hands-free. What are your thoughts on that, James and Linda and Todd? James.
Well, I think the movement towards hands-free is really growing, but there's resistance in the legislature, and part of it is you know, the fact that a lot of legislators like to use their phones when they're in their car, and they don't have hands-free devices. But I don't know if it's going to happen this year,
mm-hmm,
but I think they'll move in that direction. There's a bill that would make, if you're using a handheld communication device, otherwise known as a cell phone, and you strike somebody with your vehicle and kill them, it's automatically a Class C felony. It's assumed that, you know, it immediately jumps to that. I don't know if that'll put the fear of God in people or not, but there's movement in that direction. It's interesting that some of the most vocal and strongest backers of hands-free legislation are people involved in the trucking industry, who already have to use hands-free devices, right. And they're like, if we have to use it, why isn't everybody using it?
I had a trucker call up my talk show just the other day and said, this is a no-brainer. Yeah. We can't use it. It's a clear line. You have to use a hands-free device or you have to wait for your text or your call. Mm-hmm. And it's unfair to have truckers given one level and the rest of the people can do what they like with their handheld devices.
Yeah, I think at least in Iowa it ought to be a primary offense, meaning that if an officer sees you poking around on your cell phone while you're driving, okay, that Linda, officer ought to be able to stop you.
Yeah, but Linda, the law enforcement will tell you, you'll have the truth tellers out there, but they'll get stopped and they'll say, I wasn't texting, I was calling.
I wasn't texting, I was reading my emails.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's...
The clear line is, if you have it in your hand... You can be fined.
But that's still better than what we have now, which means if you an officer sees you poking around on your cell phone, they can't stop you because
right.
it's not a primary offense.
Right. Okay.
So at least then you've made that stop, you've made that reminder. It's better than where we are at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Moving on, unless we have other remarks about that, we want to get to, of course, unified Republican control of our legislature as well as the governor's office, the defunding of so-called abortion providers, chiefly meaning Planned Parenthood here. I don't even know where we are in that process right now. Can any of you enlighten me, James, perhaps?
It's past the Senate and it's in the House. I don't know if they'll do anything before the final deadline since it's already eligible because it's passed a committee in the Senate. So it's met the final deadline. So there may not be any action until after March 3rd, I think it is, mm-hmm. is the final deadline. But, yeah, it'll come up in the House, and there may be more abortion-related legislation introduced.
Thoughts from our columnist, Linda?
Well, I did get an email from Bob Vanderplatz of the Family Leader today telling me Monday is the day when life lives or dies in Iowa. So I'm assuming there might be some action on that bill or something similar.
I think that's probably other abortion-related legislation that will be introduced next week to meet the final deadline. They'll introduce it probably Monday, go to subcommittee Tuesday, in committee Wednesday, and you know, they've met the deadline. The bills have to be reported out of one committee to be eligible for further debate after March 3rd.
I want to do a couple things before we end this hour. We have a few minutes left. I want to backtrack to the distracted, impaired driving here and take an audience poll that just occurred to me. I want you to be honest, deadly honest, okay? How many of you clap if you have texted while driving? Thank you. Thank you for your honesty. How many of you have used your cell phone for calling with your hand up to your ear without a hands-free device? Okay. So I'm going to say that's the majority, at least on the calling, perhaps half on the texting. Of this same crowd, how many, because of the statistics, the road deaths, how many are willing to put down your handheld devices and have a clear slate and say, if you've got it in your hands, don't be behind the wheel? Are you in favor of that? Maybe that's a little bit of audio we need to send to the legislatures. Before we go, our pint glass with Donald Trump tweets has been so lonely. Let's finish off the hour with each of you taking one, and again you can choose one and answer it. These are short, snappy answers. Let's see, James, can I ask you to lead off reading your tweet from Donald Trump? These are noteworthy, newsworthy Trump tweets.
This Russian connection nonsense is merely an attempt to cover up the many mistakes made in Hillary Clinton's losing campaign.
LOL.
Oh, well.
Sad.
Sad, exclamation point, yes. Sad, exclamation
okay, very
point.
Good, very good. You don't exceed the character numbers with right. that one, for sure, no matter how many exclamation points you have. Thank you for being with us. Everybody here has turned out at the mill for Iowa Public Radio and the Gazette's Pints and Politics edition. It's been a real joy to have you here, and we want to thank especially our panelists, Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and James Lynch of the Gazette. Thank you. Thank you all for your great questions.
Pints and Politics, recorded yesterday evening at the Mill in Iowa City. Our producer, Lindsay Moon. Sound engineer, Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.